Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
We're launching a free new Aquinas 101 digital platform. Dive into the world of St. Thomas Aquinas with a customized learning environment, certificates of achievement, interactive elements, and a redesigned digital Summa Theologiae featuring a side-by-side Latin to English translation. To be notified when the platform goes live, sign up at go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. That's go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. Calling all university students, immerse yourself in the ancient and medieval Roman intellectual tradition while living in the Eternal City. Apply now for our Spring 2025 Study Abroad program. The deadline is August 15th and space is limited. Don't miss out. Apply today at ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Okay, as the title for my talk suggests, I've been asked to speak to you about the topic of divine simplicity and identity. More precisely, about the question of how can God be identical to his properties? This question raises what is perhaps the standard objection to the doctrine of divine simplicity from contemporary analytic philosophers. And I don't think it's hard to see why. The doctrine of divine simplicity requires that God is absolutely simple and hence devoid of any complexity whatsoever. And on the traditional understanding of this doctrine, it excludes not only the complexity associated with the possession of ordinary material parts or even temporal parts, but it also excludes the complexity associated with the possession of distinct properties or attributes. And here I would direct you to the second item under A on the handout, where I indicate that on the traditional understanding, there is no distinction between God and his nature, existence, goodness, power, or wisdom. On the contrary, God is identical to each of these things, as well as to anything else that can be truly predicated of him, at least as he is in himself. But this understanding of the doctrine immediately leads us to the standard objection. For it seems to require that God is identical to his properties or attributes, something which I think it's fair to say strikes most contemporary analytic philosophers as absurd. Here I direct you to the third item under A. So speaking of the doctrine of divine simplicity, C.B. Martin once said, "The trouble with the idea is just that it's hogwash." That word really cracks me up. I don't think you can get away with saying that anymore. But I think it's pretty clear what it means. Some people go even further and suggest, as Quentin Smith once did, that this doctrine is plainly self-contradictory, and its hold on people's minds testifies to the predominance of faith over intellectual coherence in some Christian circles. Those two are fighting words. In the remainder of this talk, what I want to do is consider with you what can and should be said in response to the standard objection. Is it really absurd to say that God is identical to his properties? And if so, what does this imply about the doctrine of divine simplicity? In addressing these questions, I'll be drawing inspiration primarily from Aquinas. But it's important, I think, to see that his understanding of divine simplicity is part of a broader tradition of thinking about the doctrine. I'll begin, therefore, with a few remarks about historical context for the traditional understanding of the doctrine. Then I'll turn to clarifying both the doctrine itself, the traditional understanding of the doctrine, and the standard objection to it. And then finally, I'll turn to what should be said in response to it. So first section, historical context. Under B on the handout, I've given you three traditional statements of divine simplicity. These are intended to show you not only that Aquinas accepts the traditional understanding of the doctrine, but also that he's not alone in this regard, but part of this broader tradition I was mentioning. So the first statement is from Augustine, who in his De Trinitate, Book 6, says, "We speak of God in many ways, as great, good, wise, blessed, true, and whatever else does not seem unworthily said of him. Nonetheless, God is identical with his greatness, which is his wisdom, and he is identical with his goodness, which is his wisdom and his greatness, and he is identical with his truth, which is all of these things. For in him, it's not one thing to be blessed and another to be great or wise or true or to be good or to be altogether himself. And Anselm, a little later, another fan of Augustine, says, life, wisdom, and all the rest are not parts of you, God, but all are one, and each of them is the whole of what you are and the whole of what the others are. Finally, we get Aquinas saying in the Summa Contra Gentiles, in every simple thing, its being and that which it is are the same. For if one were not the other, simplicity would be removed. As we have shown, however, God is absolutely simple. Hence in God, being good is not anything distinct from him. He is his goodness. Okay, so I think these statements show there is this traditional understanding that appears to have the consequences we were mentioning. And you might wonder, what's the motivation for this particular understanding of the doctrine? And I think the short answer is perfect being theology, where by perfect being theology, I have in mind an approach to theology that takes for granted that God is perfect or a perfect being, where perfection involves, at very least, attributes like omnipotence, omniscience, omnibenevolence, or perfect goodness, necessary existence, and so on. Now, although perfection involves these other attributes, perfection itself is not to be identified with those attributes. So you might ask, what is perfection? And I think there's, at least in the Latin West, there's two different conceptions at work. What I'll call the evaluative and the metaphysical conceptions of perfection. I think you can see both of these conceptions at work in Augustine, in particular in Confessions, Book 7, but they get picked up, I think, and by later folks in the tradition, and they tend to run with one or the other. So, for example, in Anselm, I think you can see the predominance of what I'm calling the evaluative conception of perfection, where the idea here is something like perfection is maximal goodness, or as Anselm likes to put it, that than which nothing greater can be conceived. To be perfect is to be as good as possible. In Aquinas, however, I think you see more of this Aristotelian metaphysical conception of perfection, where perfection is understood as maximal actuality, that which possesses no potentiality. Okay, so far so good, but how is this supposed to lead us to divine simplicity? Well, as it turns out, being perfect or perfection on either the evaluative or the metaphysical conception is standardly taken to require that God not only possesses those other attributes I mentioned, omnipotence, omniscience, perfect goodness, and so on, but also another attribute, which we might refer to as primacy. And primacy immediately entails simplicity. So to say that God is first or primary is just to say that God doesn't depend on anything else. He doesn't depend on anything distinct from himself, and everything distinct from God depends on him. And I think you can see it's a pretty short step from primacy, so understood, to simplicity. If God's primary, he must be simple, since if he were complex, he'd have to have parts or properties on which he depended. Okay, so much for this little primer on what leads Aquinas and others to accept the traditional doctrine of divine simplicity. Let's now take a closer look at what the doctrine itself says and see what that implies. If we look back at the statements of divine simplicity by Augustine, Anselm, and Aquinas, I think it's clear that the traditional doctrine requires God to be identical with something, namely, whatever is truly predicated of him, at least as he is in himself. And then I've just put this little statement of the traditional doctrine under E, so you'll have a handy reference. But we might wonder, what exactly does it mean for something to be predicated of God as he is in himself? To get clear about this, I think we need to think a little bit about how Aquinas and others in the tradition are thinking about predication. So a predication is a statement of this form. This is supposed to give you the kind of structural idea, where this is the grammatical subject, the term A is the grammatical subject, is the linking verb or copula, and F is supposed to be a predicate term. That is a linguistic term that when you combine it with a grammatical subject via the copula, it predicates something of A itself, where here's my little legend. This is reference, and my handwriting's not too good. This is predication. So you have a predication when you have a statement of this form, and the predicate term predicates something of the subject. As this formulation is intended to suggest, in any given statement of the form, A is F, we need to distinguish the grammatical subject from the subject of predication. The grammatical subject is a linguistic term, whereas the subject of predication is the thing in the world referred to by the grammatical subject. I've got some little example predications. Socrates is wise and God is wise. In the statement Socrates is wise, the linguistic term Socrates is the grammatical subject, whereas Socrates himself is the subject of predication. And what's being predicated of Socrates by this predication is wisdom. Likewise, in the statement God is wise, the term God is the grammatical subject, God himself is the subject of predication, and what's being predicated of God by such a statement is wisdom. That's the basic idea. I'll have to clarify things a bit. Now, in the context of divine simplicity, we're only concerned with certain types of predication. In particular, we're only concerned with divine predications. That is, predications that have God as their subject. So we're not really concerned with predications like Socrates is wise, but it's useful to have them as a contrast. We might say, we're interested with divine predications. Those have God as the subject of predication, not creaturely predications, which have creatures like Socrates as their subject. What's more, we're not concerned with all divine predications, but only with those that are true, or at least arguably true. So we're not concerned with predications like God is foolish, or limited, or impotent, or things like that. As it happens, we're not even concerned with all true divine predications, but only with those, as I indicated earlier, that predicate something of God as he is in himself. That is, only with true divine predications that are what are nowadays often called intrinsic. A predication like God is wise would appear to be a predication of this sort, since what it predicates of God is something he is in himself, considered all by himself. By contrast, a predication like God is a creator would appear to be a true divine predication that is extrinsic rather than intrinsic, since it predicates something of God not as he is in himself, but only as he is in relation to other things, namely creatures. Okay, so we now have a fairly precise way of stating what the traditional doctrine of divine simplicity requires God to be identical to, namely, whatever is predicated of him by a true intrinsic predication. Now, to this point, I've been speaking as if what predications of the form A is F predicate of their subject is F-ness. So, for example, I suggested that Socrates is wise predicates wisdom of Socrates, and that God is wise predicates the same thing of God. And we might be tempted to say the same thing about other predications. What Socrates is powerful and God is powerful, predicate of God, it might seem, is power of God, and Socrates is power. Strictly speaking, however, and here's the sort of clarification I warned that I would need to introduce later, we want to leave open, or we should leave open, the possibility that God's wisdom is an entity distinct from Socrates's. To do this, we should say that what Socrates is wise or powerful predicates of Socrates is the wisdom that Socrates has, the wisdom that belongs to Socrates. Whereas what God is wise or powerful predicates of God is the wisdom that God has. We can put this more generally by saying what a predication of the form A is F predicates of its subject is the kind of F-ness that subject has. And since A is our dummy subject, we could call this A is F-ness. So when a statement of this form is true, what it predicates of its subject is the kind of F-ness that that subject has. I should note that expressions like wisdom, power, or F-ness are often referred to as abstract singular terms. And that's because grammatically they're the abstract counterpart of the corresponding concrete terms. So I think I have a little chart that lists this. Wisdom, power, these are linguistically abstract terms corresponding to the concrete, wise, and powerful. And so F-ness would be the abstract singular term corresponding to F. One thing that's very funny about English is that the rules for constructing abstract singular terms is very complicated. This is why it's hard to learn English. What's the abstract term for human? Humanity. What's the abstract term for wise? Wisdom. What's the abstract term for white? Whiteness. In Latin, it's kind of nice. You just have the stem and you add itas, except albedo. But for the most part, it's simple. It's nice to have English as your first language. You don't have to worry about that kind of thing. Okay, putting this all together, we can now state in, I think, a perfectly general and precise way what the traditional doctrine of divine simplicity requires God to be identical to. Namely, the entities referred to by certain abstract singular terms, those of the form as fnes. And then I kind of put this in a more formulaic way. If an intrinsic predication of the form God is f is true, then God's fness exists, because that's what's predicated of him, and it's identical to God, because the doctrine requires God to be identical to what's predicated of him. Okay, so now I want to move from this understanding of the traditional doctrine to the standard objection and see if we can't get clear about that objection. So if you look closely at my formulation of the traditional doctrine, you'll see that there's nothing in it that requires God to be identical to any properties. It does require that God is identical to each of the entities intrinsically predicated of him, goodness, power, wisdom, and so on, but it doesn't explicitly identify those entities with properties. Even so, the question arises, what would these entities be if not properties? Things like goodness, power, and wisdom certainly seem like properties. It's natural to understand them as properties. And in the case of things other than God, it seems like they must be understood in this way. At least sometimes. Aquinas describes Socrates' goodness, power, and wisdom as forms or properties. And Aquinas often speaks as if what any true statement of the form predicates of its subject is a form or property. So Aquinas often speaks as if what entities that are referred to by the relevant sort of abstract singular term are forms. And forms are naturally understood as properties, things that exist in other things. All this to say, I think it's very natural to interpret the traditional doctrine of divine simplicity in terms of what I call the property account of predication and abstract reference. This is just a fancy way of saying it's natural to interpret it in terms of a theory of predication and abstract reference, according to which the things predicated of their subject and referred to by the corresponding abstract singular terms are properties. And to make it fit exactly with the way I've stated the doctrine, if an intrinsic predication of the form A is F is true, then A's Fness exists, since that's what's predicated of A, and that thing is a property, because that's the natural way to understand those sorts of things. And of course, if we combine PA with DS, if we interpret the doctrine in terms of this theory of predication, we immediately get the standard interpretation of the doctrine. God's identical to each of his properties, or at least those that are intrinsically predicated of him. Now, of course, if we interpret the doctrine in light of this account of predication and abstract reference, we're immediately faced with the standard objection. This interpretation requires that God's identical to certain properties, namely each of those that can be intrinsically predicated. So that just leads to the idea that God is a property, or is identical to his properties and is whatever they are. Now, at this point, it might be wondered, is it really absurd to identify God with certain of his properties? What's the problem here? What's supposed to be the problem? Perhaps the most influential answer to this question comes from Alvin Plantinga. In his 1980 Aquinas lecture, Plantinga pointed out that if God is identical to any of his properties, he must himself be a property. But that's what I think seems absurd, or at least most absurd. Plantinga also mentions that if he's identical to each of his properties, each of the properties are identical. And that's, he says, a kind of problem. But he says the problem that's truly monumental is that it forces us to say that God is identical to a property. Indeed, although Plantinga doesn't put it this way, I think his point is that it seems like it's a category mistake to identify God with a property. God is a person. Or maybe it's better to say he's a personal being, since in the context of the Trinity we want to allow that he's three persons. But he's the sort of being that has the features characteristic of a person. But no, person is a property. Here's how Plantinga himself puts the point. in what has become the locus classicus for the standard objection. No property could have created the world. No property could be omniscient, or indeed know anything at all. If God is a property, then he isn't a person, but a mere abstract object. He has no knowledge, awareness, power, love, or life. So taken, the simplicity doctrine seems an utter mistake. Hogwash, as C.B. Martin says. Okay, so now to the final part of the presentation, responding to the standard objection. The main strategy since Plantinga, although things have changed more recently, but I think for many years, the discussion of Dion simplicity in the contemporary analytic literature on philosophy of religion was dominated by this Plantingarian objection. And I think it's fair to say that the standard, perhaps the main strategy for responding to the objection, was to grant Plantinga that it's absurd to identify God with properties if we conceive of properties as abstract objects, but then to point out that this isn't the only way to conceive of properties. In fact, just like we had this distinction among grammatical terms between abstract and concrete, so too there's a metaphysical distinction between abstract and concrete. And maybe if we don't conceive of properties as abstract, but move to a concrete conception, things will be better. Okay, well, what does this distinction come to? Well, abstract objects are causally inert, and so don't have any efficient causal powers. Obviously, therefore, God can't be an abstract property because he's a person, or a person-like being, and has all kinds of causal powers. But as I mentioned, properties don't have to be conceived of as abstract objects. They can also be conceived of as concrete objects having genuine causal powers. So why not just say God is a concrete property? Well, there's still a worry here because, again, at least among contemporary analytic types, it's natural to conceive of properties, whether abstract or concrete, as universals. This is how Plantinga is conceiving of them. But God can't be a universal any more than he can be an abstract object. As it happens, there are philosophers, analytic types, who conceive of properties as particular rather than universal. For some reason, I don't really understand. They like to call these particular properties tropes. Tropes are usually thought of as dependent beings. And of course, given God's primacy, he can't be a dependent being. Fortunately, there are some trope theorists that allow that particular properties or tropes can be independent. So why not just say God is a certain type of trope or particular property, namely one of the independent, one of what, was it A.J. Ayer that called these junior substances? Although this strategy for making sense of divine simplicity might seem to have some initial promise, in the end, I think it suffers from the same basic problem that Plantinga originally identified. It just seems to be a part of the concept of a property that it's an entity that's capable of being in something else, whether we understand this capacity in terms of a dependency or not. Properties are, as contemporary analytics like to say, exemplifiable. That is, they're capable of being instantiated or possessed or informing other things. But no person isn't exemplifiable. That seems like a category mistake. Though I know of at least one philosopher who suggested that's okay. Just say God's a self-exemplifying property. But that seems like a counter. That seems like a kind of mistake. If that's right, however, then whatever else we say about properties, that is, whether they're abstract or concrete, universal or particular, dependent or independent, it will still seem like hogwash to say that God is a property. In the end, therefore, I think it's better to adopt a different strategy for making sense of divine simplicity, one that doesn't require identifying God with any properties. In particular, I want to suggest that instead of combining the traditional doctrine with the property account of predication and abstract reference, we combine it with another theory or account of predication and abstract reference, what I call the truth maker account of predication and abstract reference. And this is at TA on the handout. And the basic idea, as you'll see there, is this is just like the property account. If an intrinsic predication of the form A is F is true, then A's F-ness exists, since that's what's predicated, but then that entity, instead of being identified with the property, is identified with a truth maker, namely a truth maker for that claim. Obviously, to fill this view out, I need to say a word or two about truth makers. A truth maker, as its name suggests, is an entity that makes a predication true. But unlike its name, it doesn't make it in the sense of efficient causation. The notion of making here is not to be understood as an efficient causal notion, but an explanatory notion. A truth maker is an entity that makes a predication true in the sense that it explains its truth. It's that in virtue of which the statement is true. I think it would be better to call these truth explainers, but unfortunately, truth making is so, what's the word, embedded in the literature that it would be a departure from standard terminology to talk of truth explainers. And by explanation, I just have in mind a certain kind of necessitation relation. If one thing explains the other, it determines it, necessitates the truth of it. Okay, now the notion of a truth maker is something of a technical term in contemporary analytic philosophy, but I think the idea is very intuitive. When Aristotle famously says, a statement is true because the way the world is, the way the world is isn't true because the way the statement is, he's getting at this intuition. We think that there are things that are true about the world, mine independently, and they're true because of the way the world is. I think, if I'm remembering right, Aristotle's example is Socrates is wise or white because that the statement is true because he's white. He's not white because the statement is true. And you can see this kind of idea, I think, in Aquinas when he speaks about the causa veritatis, the cause of truth. So he says things like this. Here's a little statement from his commentary on Metaphysics. When I say Socrates is human, or when I assert that statement, the truth of this statement is explained by the composition of the form of humanity with the individual matter by which Socrates is this human. So what makes it true that Socrates is human is a certain hylomorphic compound. Likewise, when I say Socrates is white, the explanation of this truth, the causa veritatis, is the composition of whiteness with the subject. So another kind of composite, an accidental unity. And similarly, he says in other such cases where I think he's thinking of intrinsic predications. Given the intuitiveness of this notion of truth maker, its presence in the tradition, my suggestion is, here's the way we should interpret the doctrine of divine simplicity. Take God to be identical, not to the properties for each of his true intrinsic predications, but for their truth makers, and hence identify him not with a property, but with a truth maker. Okay, and I think if we take this strategy, then the main worry, the apparent incoherence of the standard interpretation, just goes away. And the main reason for this is just that the truth maker interpretation is an ontologically neutral one on the nature of the entities referred to by the relevant abstract singular terms. To identify something as a property is to locate it in a certain kind of category, or to identify it as an entity with a certain type of nature, one that exists in other things. But to characterize something as a truth maker is to characterize it in terms of a certain kind of functional role it plays, that of explaining the truth of the predications it makes true. But such a functional characterization places no restrictions on the specific nature or ontological category to which a truth maker can belong. So it could be a property, but it could be a person. Anything can be a truth maker. And in fact, I think it turns out to be the case that God is a good candidate for the truth maker of each of his true intrinsic predications, since apart from a few special cases, which I refuse to discuss here, and we'll just punt for Matthew to take up. Matthew's, his mere existence would seem to suffice for their truth. So if God is wise, God himself would seem to suffice for the truth of that. And here again, I think you can see, I mean, to talk about truth makers as ontologically neutral, this sounds technical and so on, but I think you see in Aquinas the same sort of idea being expressed using the term forms. So although he talks about predications as predicating of their subject forms, and that might suggest properties, what he adds in various contexts is, by a form in this context, I don't really mean to be talking about a form as a categorical entity, as an entity that has to exist in something else. So I've given you one representative passage here from De Potentia. Here Aquinas says, it's not necessary that by which, or we might even say in virtue of which, something is denominated an F, always be a form in extramental reality. On the contrary, it's sufficient that it be something signified in the mode of a form, grammatically speaking. Thus, a human being is denominated an agent by its action, clothed by its clothing, and an F by other things of this sort. But these are not really forms. Now, unfortunately, one thing that this passage is complicated a little bit, because instead of speaking of predication, he speaks of denomination. But there's a close connection for Aquinas between predication and denomination. Whenever you have a statement of this form that's true, and so a true predication, the predicate term not only predicates something of A, but Aquinas is happy to say it denominates A on the basis of the very thing that it predicates of A, namely a form. And so I think it's clear that he's talking here about that in virtue of which the statement is true, and indicating that what I'm calling forms here don't have to be forms in reality. They could be clothes, whatever it is that an action is, and so on. Okay, so I think if we adopt this truth maker interpretation, we not only get an interpretation that makes good sense of the doctrine, but also fits well with the tradition. I focused on Aquinas here, but I think similar things could be said for Augustine and Anselm. Now, I don't mean to suggest that my interpretation has no substantive commitments. It's hard to get away with doing anything in philosophy without substantive commitments. But it's one thing to have substantive commitments. It's another thing to say things that are category mistakes or don't make any sense. I've listed some of the substantive commitments. They all seem okay to me. I certainly think they seem coherent, and they're certainly taken for granted as coherent by many, many truth maker theorists nowadays, but they're substantive nonetheless. So one obvious commitment of my interpretation is that intrinsic predications, true intrinsic predications of the form A is F, have truth makers. Another substantive commitment that might seem a bit more foreign from the contemporary perspective is that we can refer to truth makers by abstract singular terms of the form F-ness or A is F-ness. And that's a little bit strange to contemporary analytic types just because we ordinarily use those terms to refer to properties. But I think on Aquinas' account, those things, the truth makers often are properties or involve properties, so it's not surprising that these expressions would, perhaps often do, refer to properties. And then finally, the interpretation does require that a single thing can be the truth maker for many things, and that a simple being, such as God, can be the truth maker for all its true intrinsic predications. But here again, I think these are at least plausible. And as I mentioned, often taken to be so by a truth maker theorist. When I was originally working on this topic, I was very annoyed that my friends kept saying that the doctrine makes no sense, and they literally meant that it's incoherent. They couldn't make sense of it. So my strategy was just to come up with a framework for making sense of it, and I thought I found that in the tradition. What happens when you do this with your philosopher friends is as soon as you convince them that it makes sense, instead of just acknowledging it and repenting of their mistake, they switch the subject and say, this is totally implausible. And then I think, yeah, but my project wasn't to defend its plausibility. It was to defend its coherence. So now we can have, finally, the discussion that we've been wanting to have about whether it's true. But if it's going to be true, it's got to at least make sense. But in any case, I want to emphasize that my initial project was to make sense of it. And I would be delighted if these friends of mine thought divine simplicity is at least as plausible or at least as controversial as truth maker theory. Okay, if we return to our original question, how can God be identical to his properties? The short answer I think we should give in response to this sort of question is he can't be. No person can be a property. But that's no problem because the doctrine of divine simplicity doesn't require God to be identical to any properties. It only requires that he can be identical to each of the truth makers for each of his true intrinsic predications, and that seems like a certainly reasonable, at least coherent position. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.